Okay, so I want to move on and zero in a bit more to draw out some of the distinctive features of the Buddhist notion of karma, and in particular, distinguishing it from the Vedic notion of karma. And I want to make 2 points, really. I'm sure there's more points, but I want to make two. First of all, it's agent-centered rather than act-centered. I'm going to explain that jargon in a minute. And secondly, it operates within the current lifetime and not only in relation to the rebirth process. So first of all, it's agent-centered. So what was distinctive about the Buddha and the Buddha's idea of karma, as opposed to or as distinguished from the Vedic one, was that the Buddha ethicized the idea of karma. Previously, karma was seen in ritualistic terms. In other words, in terms of the performance of a particular ritual in the appropriate way. So you do this ritual in the right way and you gain positive karmic consequences as a result. And the most outstanding example of this was the performance of certain rites after the death, particularly performed by the son, performed for the dead father. And the performance of these rites in the proper way would lead to what was called positive karma, which would supposedly somehow be transferred to the departed relative, which would benefit them in the after-death state. I mean, that opens up a whole other area about the transference of karma, which I'm not actually going to go into, but you might want to ask about that at some point. Instead of this, instead of seeing karma in terms of ritual and the performance of particular actions in the right way, what the Buddha said was, what's most important about karma is intention, is the intention behind your action, not the surface of the action. So, in many places, karma is equated with chetana, or volition, or will. So it's volition, or will, that is karma in Buddhism. And this is a very radical thing to say. It's a very radical move in terms of how to govern one's conduct and behaviour. So action becomes a primarily mental thing as opposed to simply a physical action, you know, physical behaviour. But this is not to say that overt action, physical action or speech, is unimportant. It's more to say that the ethical quality of a speech act or, you know, physical behaviour can only be understood by understanding the motivation that drove it. So you can't simply look at someone's behaviour and then know their physical behaviour and know that they performed an unskillful or indeed a skillful action. You need to know more about what was driving them, more about their motivation. So intentions can be divided into two kinds: kusala, which means skillful, or akusala, which means unskillful. So a skillful intention is one that arises from positive emotion. And these in particular are defined as generosity, intelligence, and compassion or love. These are skillful motivations for action. Then the unskillful motives, the unskillful intentions, are seen in terms of craving, hatred, and spiritual ignorance, delusion. So as I said, the ethical quality of an action can't be understood simply by examining the surface of it. Just to give an example, two people might give me a gift. One of them may give me a gift because he wants to express his gratitude for me helping him to fix his roof. Very unlikely, actually, but maybe that would happen. So out of gratitude, gives to me. The other person wants to ingratiate himself with me because he wants to prepare the ground to borrow some money. So superficially, they're both giving. It seems a very positive thing, but actually they're driven by quite different motives. One out of a very positive motive of gratitude, the other out of a desire to try to manipulate me to prepare the ground to get something out of me. So you can see that superficially the actions are the same, but actually they'll have very different consequences. That's what I'm going to come on to now. The effects of karma, the consequences of karma. So every act that we perform, every intentional act that we perform, that is, modifies our being. It modifies who we are. As I've said earlier, we're constantly changing, And what makes us change is each little intention, each little act that we perform over the days, weeks, years, etc. Sometimes these acts modify us in a big way, and sometimes in just a small way. Depends on the act. These consequences, or these effects, are called vipakas, or fruits. And I think the metaphor, the analogy of fruit is very good. Because, well, what is a fruit? Is something that, that kind of grows on the basis of, say, a tree, if you like. So let's say your previous action is the tree. The tree is there. Then that tree will blossom into fruit. There'll be a natural organic consequence, if you like. So it's not that somebody then comes along and sticks some fruit on the tree. It's kind of implicit. It's kind of organic within the tree itself that the fruits will arise, that the fruits will emerge. I think this is quite important, really. It's not that somebody will come along and punish you for being bad. It's that the consequences of your conduct are inherent in the conduct itself. They're inseparable, if you like. And the primary consequence is that you will be changed by your conduct. So let's just take an example. I act out of a very hateful, angry state of mind over a period of time. What will the consequences of that be? The primary consequence will be that I will be a hateful, angry person. That's the primary consequence. There'll probably be other consequences too, like people won't like me very much. They won't want to help me. But these are secondary consequences. The primary consequence is that I will be changed by acting out these particular intentions and volitions. The thing is, it's not always obvious that we are reshaping our being in this way. And sometimes it can take actually quite a long time for the fruits of our conduct to show themselves, either skillful or unskillful. I don't know whether any of you have read Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, but it's a very, very good novel and well worth reading. And Dorian Gray is this extremely selfish aesthete, and he's very, very handsome. And I can't quite remember how this happens in the book, but he makes some kind of pact whereby, however evilly he acts, he continues to look very young, handsome, and people continue to like him. But his portrait, which he keeps in his attic, shows all the marks of his evil, unskillful conduct. Towards the end of his life, he's still very, very beautiful, people still like him, and so on, goes up to the attic and has a look at this picture. And it's all old and, you know, really ugly, and it's all kind of, his face is festering, this sort of thing. And he dies at that point, and if you like, the consequences of his previous actions are then transferred from the picture onto him. Now, I don't want to say that karma is like that. I'm just using this as an analogy to say that it's not always obvious. So you may, for example, act very, very skillfully and positively for many, many years, and seemingly all these bad things happen to you. You know, all sorts of things. People are horrible to you. You know, you get mugged. Your car gets stolen. And you think to yourself, well, what have I done to deserve this? And actually, maybe you've not done anything to deserve it. These things happen. Or maybe you see somebody else who just seems incredibly selfish, and they just want to get whatever they can out of other people, and seemingly they do very well. You know, they do very, very well out of life. You're thinking, well, how can this be true? How can this principle of karma be true if this person who's acting so unskillfully is seemingly being rewarded for that? Well, I think, you know, it's a question of confidence. In the longer term, there will be an effect, and sometimes things kind of come to a head and the consequences sort of arrive all at once. But I want to make the point, you know, I'm making this point because I think we can think, well, there should be some sort of quid pro quo thing. I've done this good thing, so where's the benefit? You know, I've done this bad thing, oh my God, where's the punishment coming from? But it's much more complex than that. And it's probably better to think in terms of a series of actions that amount to a habit, and that habit, if you like, has its effect on you as a person, and then it will have wider effects on your social circle and on the world generally, rather than in terms of individual actions, you know, having much of an effect. Okay, so from a Buddhist point of view, what we're trying to do is strengthen the skillful motivations, the skillful intentions, and weaken and eradicate the unskillful ones. That, if you like, is the purpose of Buddhist ethics. That's what it aims to do. And we do this through purifying the mind, through working on the mind directly, rather than through any external kind of purification. So, for example, you know, bathing in the Ganges is not, from a Buddhist point of view, going to bring about purification. Or, you know, performing some other particular kind of ritual practice is not necessarily going to bring about purification. See, I'm not saying that those things won't, but they will only bring about purification if they're aligned with the appropriate intention, the appropriate motivation. The acts aren't enough in themselves. So the kind of practices that a Buddhist engages in are meditation, which aims to work directly on the mind to change the mind positively, and of course ethics, the following of a particular ethical code, a particular set of precepts. And I think it's important to recognise that it isn't simply an external observance of these ethical precepts that will bring about the transformation. There has to be the corresponding intention, the corresponding mental skillfulness, if you like, that goes with it. So, you know, one might say, well, okay, giving is seen to be a positive thing in Buddhism. If I give a lot, then I'll become, you know, enlightened. But actually, if you give, you know, grudgingly or with regret, well, actually, that isn't going to bring about this purification. It has to be allied with this open-hearted intention. And of course, that's a process that, you know, we work towards. It's not the case that we're going to be completely pure overnight. It's a process of gradual transformation and purification through action, through meditation, and all the other practices that Buddhists engage in. Okay, and well, this purification can ultimately lead to what Buddhists call enlightenment. It'll lead to a shift away from self-centeredness to another regarding approach to life, if you like, an approach of compassion to life.